Look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the films of Orson Welles, as recommended by Tyler Smith, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about Welles' 1965 Shakespeare-ish, adaptation-ish, of Falstaff Chimes at Midnight. Back to my regularly scheduled program, as I said, would be, hooray, on schedule, it feels so good. And I have to say that, I was a little bit worried about getting into Chimes at Midnight because I was initially worried about, like, hey, I haven't read any of Shakespeare's historical dramas, I haven't read any of the Henry plays, and so I'm not familiar with the Falstaff character, so is that going to be something which is going to hold me back from my access, my relating, my understanding of the film that I was going to be watching? And so I was very nervous and hesitant about that, and then I sat down and finally watched the film and said, okay, I don't have to worry about that. Instead, I just have to worry about the fact that me and Shakespeare really don't seem to mesh very well with each other. So I have to say that I'm going to apologize ahead of time if this episode is a little bit shorter than the standard one. Certainly, I talked for a long time about The Stranger. I love that movie. Chimes at Midnight, I didn't really connect with, and it all has to do with not necessarily anything Welles did as a writer, as a filmmaker, as an actor, but guys and girls, I have to confess that Shakespeare has, since high school, always made me feel very dumb, and I'm sure that that's not an experience which is exclusive to me, but due to Shakespeare's wonderful talent with language and with double meaning and entendre and his skill with words and meter and all that sort of stuff, which goes into what makes a Shakespeare play so special, has also been the stuff that has made me unable on my own to sort of be able to really access and connect with the things that he has been writing, or has been writing, that he has written. There have been two times in my life where I really kind of felt what I would say appropriate respect and appreciation for the writings of Shakespeare, and that was in college in my intro to English course, in which, you know, we dabbled a little bit in Shakespeare and some of his plays, and then I took a Shakespeare course the following year in college, in which we actually covered, I think, 6 or 8 of his plays in a semester, and it was fantastic, you know, but it was also under the guise or the leadership of a professor to help dissect and analyze and break down what we were reading, and I was also doing it within a community in which, you know, people had ideas and people had questions, and there was this feedback and there was this discussion, and they were both obviously very academic situations in which discussion, questions, analyzation, and I was about to say analysis, that's the same thing. Analysis, did I just say analyzation? I'm sorry, I meant analysis. Analysis, but context, and all this kind of stuff, you know, we could break down Shakespeare on a granular level, so that way I could read a stanza or a page or hell, a scene, and know what I was reading and understand and digest it, because I was doing it under the tutelage of this person who was smarter than me, who was wiser than me, who had been down this path before and could also kind of help me understand what this eloquent, flowery, but dense language was getting at. My Shakespeare professor was actually also quite an expert in Old English. In Old English, as you've actually come to, not that you've come to know, but that you actually haven't really known, you know, actual Old English, which, despite the fact it was English, was incredibly difficult to understand and read, you know, but he was all into that shit. That was his jam, you know, so it was impressive. It was almost kind of watching an artist create something, just kind of hearing him talk about Shakespeare and hearing him break down the language and how this could refer to that and all those kind of stuff. And it was wonderful. And this is a roundabout way of kind of saying, any time that I have been able to really connect with a work of Shakespeare, and I'm talking about the actual work of Shakespeare. I'm not talking about something like 10 Things I Hate About You, which is sort of a modern day updating of Shakespeare in terms that we can understand, but actually Shakespeare's words and his work. The only time that I've been able to really be able to engage with that stuff is when doing it in conjunction with other people or a person who has been able to provide me that historical and linguistic context. It'll help me break it down and dissect it, you know. I still have, to this day, I still have from that class the complete works of Shakespeare, and I haven't gotten rid of it, despite the fact that I haven't cracked it open since college, because I recognize that it is a significant literary achievement of knowledge and of art, and it is a historically and artistically significant tome. I don't want to get rid of it because I feel like I'd be getting rid of knowledge, basically. But I also haven't cracked it open because, well, one, it's just awkward and cumbersome to be carrying that thing around on the subway, but also, I don't know, just doing it myself, just trying to engage with it on my own terms without that expert, without that knowledge, you know, I don't have the time or really the patience, maybe even the ability to do so, where I'd have to be stopping every now and again to kind of look up that word and kind of see what the context is and really take my time and be deliberate about it. I don't have the time or the patience to really do that. And that is a limitation for me. It's not that I don't think that I am dumb, but Shakespeare makes me feel that way because I can't just engage with it as it is. Like I have to take my time and be slow and be deliberate about it. And I kind of most of the time want to avoid the hassle, so I don't do it. If I don't understand something right away, which, you know, isn't to say that I understand everything right away, but, you know, certainly I want to be able to kind of try and understand something, you know, try and engage with an idea or a person on their own terms. And if I can't do that right away, it gets very frustrating for me because, I do consider myself a relatively intelligent person. And if I don't understand something right away, I kind of start thinking like, oh, what's wrong? I'm such an idiot. I'm such an idiot about this. And Shakespeare is that all the time for me. And so this is essentially a very long-winded way of saying I was lost throughout watching Chimes of Midnight for the most part because it's still, despite the fact that it's not a Shakespeare play, but it is parts of scenes, or I should say it is actually scenes from real Shakespeare plays that are sort of compiled and maybe rewritten to a certain extent to kind of make this one story out of this supporting minor character we've seen in a few different plays. Despite the fact that it's not an actual Shakespeare play, it still is the words, and if not the words, the spirit of William Shakespeare, which is to say, heady, dense, flowery, and just... It, watching a movie doesn't afford me the luxury of being able to stop and kind of be like, okay, what am I watching here? What is this line saying? What are these words? On a granular level, what does this word mean? Okay, now I know what these words mean. What is it saying in the sentence? Okay, now that I know what the sentence is, what is the context of the sentence? What is the context of the scene, et cetera, et cetera, building it out. I don't have that luxury. I didn't have that luxury of Chimes of Midnight. Sure, I suppose I could have done that and sort of paused every now and again and looked up stuff, but then a two-hour viewing experience becomes many more hours, or maybe it's split up, and I just don't have the time to do that kind of stuff. And so then not just having the trouble of being able to engage with Shakespeare's words, but it is then further exacerbated by the fact that I can't be paying full attention to the words because I also have to be paying, to a certain extent, attention to the visuals, to the performances, certainly, but then also Orson Welles as a phenomenal director. What is he doing with the direction? What is he doing with this movie to kind of make it more than just a filmed adaptation of a Shakespeare play? You know, it's not just popping a camera down in front of a stage and letting people do their thing, or you know, this is Orson Welles. This is a director, and the context is, this is Orson Welles, a director who was kind of seen as past his prime. Is that the right way of putting it? But certainly whose career was sort of in the dumps a little bit, especially considering that Touch of Evil in 1958 didn't do very well. That was supposed to rejuvenate his career, and it didn't. So this is kind of him at his lowest, as one of his lowest points. And this is commonly seen as the movie that is the best of his second half of his career. Knowing that, then it's like, okay, then this is clearly something which is going to be important and significant, so I have to start paying attention to what about this is significant on a visual level, aside from just on a story and linguistic level. And so my attention is sort of split, and because it's split and I can't pay full attention to one thing or another, then stuff ends up getting lost, and a lot of which got lost was, what is going on in this movie? Which I feel bad admitting, because, you know, I wanted, it's sort of me saying, like, hey, by the way, everyone, I'm kind of dumb, or I kind of don't understand certain things. But then also it sacrifices the quality of, like, well, how am I supposed to make an episode out of this now, because I don't really understand what I'm reading. But Shakespeare has always been difficult for me to engage with, and when it comes to Orson Welles, who is a person who is going to engage with Shakespeare on his terms, because Orson Welles started in a theater, because Orson Welles was a theater director, was a theater actor, was a guy who loved theater, his first passion was that, then this is a guy who's not going to pull any punches. This is a guy who is going to go all in on it, and he certainly does, and it's admirable, but I was lost a lot in Chimes of Midnight as to what was going on. What's the context of this conversation? What is the status of their relationship? What is the story that I'm watching? And so I found it a frustrating viewing experience for me. And I have to put that out right away, he says, after talking for minutes about his own ignorance. I have to kind of put that out first, because I sort of have to provide context for a conversation or a discussion in which I don't know how much I'm going to say or add to this, because I'm not entirely sure what I watched. I mean, certainly I read the Wikipedia page on this movie to kind of go back and get the plot stuff down, and so I understand now what happened, but while I'm watching, I'm just thinking, I don't know what is going on in this scene, and that made it very difficult for me to engage with this film. Normally I have problems engaging with films because I disagree with what the director is doing, or maybe there's a disconnect, or objectively, I just don't like the movie for one reason or another. But this one, I don't like saying I don't get it, but obviously sometimes, like especially with Tarkovsky, it happened where I wasn't sure about the motivations behind shots and scenes and sequences and that kind of stuff. And that's more of a, I know there's an intentionality behind here, I'm just not sure what the motivation is. So I kind of have to respond instead based on what I drew from these things, what I got out of it. But with this one, it was a different story, because I wasn't able to follow the language and the narrative. So if I don't know what's going on with the dialogue, I don't know what the relationships are, and if I don't really know what the people are commenting on, I don't really know which direction the story is going in. And so then it's like, well, what am I commenting on then? So instead I sort of have to compromise and still at least comment on something. And so after having gone through that whole tangent, tirade, whatever you want to call it, about how I wasn't really sure what was going on, I can still say that clearly, this is obvious to anyone besides me as of this moment, clearly there is a talent involved with making this. There is a writer-director with a vision and with a clear idea, because despite the fact that I didn't really understand what was going on, I still, to an extent, understood how the mood was changing, and sort of emotionally at least, in how the narrative was moving along. Even though if I didn't necessarily understand the explicit details of people's relationships, I generally understood at least the levels on which they saw each other. Who is the superior, for lack of a better word, of the relationship, and who is sort of the underling? What do these people sort of feel about themselves? Okay, this decision that was just made, even though I don't understand it, how has that changed the emotion, basically? And so I understood because of Welles's performances, because of how he shot certain things, I at least understood how the emotions of all the characters were moving forward, and that kind of gave me a general sense of how these characters are changing as the movie goes along, even if I didn't really understand what was happening as the movie was going along. And some of you out there might have been thinking, hey, if you had trouble watching this movie, why didn't you just turn on the subtitles so you could read it? I did. I did that partway through, and I still wasn't really sure I could understand what was going on, which is, and then also adds another layer of splitting my attention, because then it's also, then I'm paying attention to reading as well, and then as I'm reading it, I'm also not paying full attention to visually what's happening on the screen. So as you can see, oh my god, this is, I hope I'm not stressing anyone out, because I'm stressing myself out just thinking about how how this was a difficult viewing experience for me. But I, like I said, I at least know sort of in general, a general sense of the relationships between these people. And a lot of that starts because of the performances, not just because of how people act certain ways, but then also how they act towards each other. And that, just like it was with The Stranger, is rooted in the fantastic performance of Orson Welles, who at this point in his career was, you know, didn't have much of a career, was severely overweight, was an alcoholic, and was, even just on a visual level, a far different person from what I saw in The Stranger. And granted, that was like 20 years earlier in his career, but it's still just, it looks like an entirely different person. But where it's similar is that, I don't even know what the word for it is, but that, like, that deep voice that he has, which kind of brings something which is reassuring, but then also has a gravity to it. When he speaks, I respected it. Whenever he was saying something, even if I didn't understand it, I was thinking, okay, there is a significance behind the words that he is saying. And once again, depending on the scene, depending who he was interacting with, I understood the general mood that Falstaff had. And especially I understood his relationship to a certain degree with Harry. You know, it's very kind of clear from the get-go that Harry and his friend are sort of, you know, not that they're malicious towards Falstaff, but there's, you know, Falstaff's kind of a buffoon, you know, he's kind of, he's immature, he's irresponsible, doesn't have a whole lot of money, but always wants something from someone, whether that's a drink or whether that's a favor or whatever, makes up these tall tales. One scene I did absolutely follow and love was, when they staged the robbery in the woods, and then Harry stages a robbery within a robbery, and then the next day or a little bit later in the day is hearing from Falstaff about the situation, and Falstaff is clearly bullshitting his way, kind of making up this story about how many men that he fought off or killed, and I think it starts with 2 and goes to 4 and 6, and eventually it's like 9 people that he fought off, when it was really just this titanic fat guy in this robe who was just kind of really running away from 2 of his friends that he didn't realize were, or 2 people that he didn't realize were his friends in costumes. And that paints a pretty clear picture of the relationship between these guys, where it's not malicious, but there is this interesting and intricate mixture of respect, of sort of a father, I was going to say father-daughter, of a father-son dynamic. So there's respect, there's that, there's a jovial quality, but then there also is sort of Falstaff is sort of the underling, you know, Harry is kind of picking on him, and there is sort of this sense of pitying this character because of what he has become. He's jovial, he's always in good spirits, and he's always joking around with people, but it's also like, who is this guy, you know, what has become of his life? He has no money, he can't afford to do anything, he's always making excuses, and he's lying a lot. But it always kind of get the sense that, like, if there's one certain thing in the world that he has, it's this friendship or this platonic love or this father-son dynamic that he has that plays out with Prince Harry. And once again, even though I didn't really understand necessarily the specifics of what was being discussed, I at least understood that there was a comfort and a lightness that was brought about from their relationship. Which, of course, makes it all the more upsetting, because, like, I, you know, all the more upsetting that that scene, not at the end scene, but the last scene that they have interacting with each other after Harry has been crowned king, after his father has died, and Falstaff interrupts the coronation ceremony to drop down to his knees because he's joyful. He is so happy that this friend that he had, that's his son-like figure, that has now become king, and he is so happy to see his, for lack of a better term, son ascend to that position. And the response is basically, "I don't know you, old man. You know, what was before is no longer." And he gets banished from the kingdom. And you just see the heartbreak. You can almost literally see the heartbreak in Falstaff. And so even if I didn't necessarily understand a whole lot of what had transpired and the nitty-gritty details of the scene, I understood, hey, their relationship was one way at the beginning and is vastly different now, and it has broken this man's heart. This man who the only thing he had in the world at this point in his life was this relationship he had with this guy. He had his best friend, he had his son figure now ascend to the most powerful position in the entire country, and this most powerful man is saying, "Away from me, old man. Get away. I don't want you to be in my life anymore. I don't have time for you. What you had, what we had, what you thought is no longer." And Orson Welles' reaction in that scene is so damn painful. I almost wanted to cry because he was crying, because I understood at least that what once was is no longer. And then shortly after that, of course, Falstaff dies. And it sounds a bit cliche to say it, but it seems like, you know, Falstaff dies of a broken heart because of what he had, the only certainty that he had, and then what he lost. And then after that, it's sort of the question of, what does he have to hang around here for anymore? And that is all started and rooted in the fantastic performance of Orson Welles, who of course brought a whole lot of personal investment to this movie, not just because this was a play that he had wanted to do for a long time. I mean, I think this was something that he had wanted to do all the way back in the 30s, or at least that he had wanted to stage this as a theater production all the way back in the 30s. But this was a movie which meant a whole lot to him, so much so that there's actually reports of filming was delayed because he had stage fright. This is Orson Welles. This is the guy who performed, who was the lead in Citizen Kane, who was the powerful force of a villain in The Stranger. This was the guy who was Harry Lime in The Third Man. You know, this guy had stage fright? That doesn't really make any sense. And I suppose that there are some personal things that, you know, or at least what was going on with his life could be influential in that, but it also could be, this was something that he had been so invested in for so long. This was the movie, I posted a quote on a Facebook page today, this was the movie that he had wanted to be known for. This was his favorite movie, which is funny that we swing, the pendulum swings in the other direction. The Stranger, his least favorite movie, to Chimes at Midnight, which was his favorite one, the one that he says if he went to heaven, this is the one he'd want to be known for. So of course there has to be some nervousness or anxiety that's built around that too, of putting so much, investing so much in something that all of a sudden it comes to its being done, like, oh man, what if I screw this up? But his performance is absolutely phenomenal, and especially because he's performing in scenes a lot of comedy. I mean, this is a very funny, I wouldn't say that this movie is a comedy, but there are comedic moments, especially like that scene where he's bullshitting about what happened with the robbery, and then also, this guy waddling around in this just oversized armor in battle, you know, hiding behind bushes, you know, not wanting to get involved, but then also at the end of the battle taking credit for killing the prince that rebelled against the crown. I mean, there's something that's very funny about that, and it's great seeing Orson Welles perform comedy, because to the best of my recollection, he didn't really do that very often, and yet he does it so well. Because once again, whenever he speaks, whenever he says something, there is that mixture of gravity and respect, but then also of pity and buffoonery, and it's amazing that he combines that all together into this character who is so complex and so interesting, and someone that we are so willing to sort of open up to want to be emotionally invested in, and then is also kind of like, oh, but this asshole, come on. That is so fascinating. That all has to do with Welles having a full understanding of this character, or at least a complete understanding of the way that he interpreted this character and wanted to play this character. And of course, as Tyler mentioned, and of course, and as I also did a bit of research on, he's also bringing something personal to this movie because of sort of how much it seems, it's sort of eerie, how much this Falstaff character and this story emulated so much of what was going on in Wells' life, both personally and critically, or I should say personally and professionally. On the personal level, you certainly have, this authority figure who rejects this other figure that sort of has this familial bond with him, and how that splitting of that relationship sort of leads to a too soon and untimely death, and sort of what connection those two things have. And certainly that gets back to the relationship that Wells had with his father, who his father was a not great person. I believe his father was an alcoholic, and Wells sort of like separated from his father, didn't want anything to do with him. And his father died not too long after their alienation. And Wells, you know, probably up until the day that he died, always felt that like he had something to do with the death of his father, that in a way that he caused it, even though objectively, scientifically, that was not true. He still was carrying around this guilt of something he did led to the death of his father. And so you have this idea of this complicated, emotionally complicated relationship in which there was one figure who clearly sort of has the emotional leverage, or at least where one person is always sort of looking up to and or relying on that person or something, then there is a rejection of that, the relationship that was no longer is, and that person eventually is just so broken that that person passes away, which is, that's seems to be, you know, there's a lot of similarities there between, you know, or in Wells's real life. So he brought that investment where sort of like, in a way, he's like, this is my story. I am basically directing my story. But then also, critically, or professionally, Falstaff's life, very much resembles Orson Welles, or at least the Orson Welles at that time, in which it was a guy who was overweight, drunk, had no money and could not really get money from anybody. He was always having to get favors from people to get things done. And, certainly had the respect of some people who were close to him, but was kind of generally looked down upon and laughed at as sort of the larger community. I mean, this is a picture of the late career Orson Welles, of someone who, sure, had a title and had a position because of something which he maybe did, like, in the past. You know, he's known as Sir, you know, and he gets a responsibility of leading an army somehow. So there is a reputation there, but it sort of seems to be based on stuff he had already done that he had, you know, long since outlived in regards to what he is now versus what his reputation says he was. And just as a character who is generally looked down upon by the larger society. That was Orson Welles in 1965. That was Orson Welles while he was making this movie. And this was supposed to be the thing that sort of got him back into the good graces. Maybe not into good financial graces, because certainly Shakespeare doesn't seem like financially has ever been a sure thing here in America. But this was supposed to be the thing that was supposed to, you know, well, Touch of Evil was supposed to rejuvenate things for him. But this was the one that was supposed to be like, hey, Orson Welles is, you know, he can still do this. He still got it. And in retrospect, and time has been very kind to it, I think the consensus now is, like I said, this is the best film of the second half of his career, but that's not how it was seen right away when it came out. And so, just a personal and a professional emulation of the life that Orson Welles led and was leading at that point is all up on screen, too. While I wasn't really able to pay as much attention to the direction as I liked because of, you know, the reasons I've outlined before, there's still at least things here which are like, hey, shit, man, this is still an Orson Welles film, and then also just stuff which causes this movie to be admired for a movie of like, wow, there is an incredibly talented director behind this movie. I'm going to steal a couple quotes here from Roger Ebert, because, of course, when in doubt, steal from Roger Ebert is my mentality on this podcast. You should know that by now. But these two paragraphs are sort of which sort of typify and explain how this is still an Orson Welles film. Because, like I said, I wasn't paying full attention to it. I kept trying to kind of think, like, okay, what visually what can I see here which I can pull from and kind of be like, yep, this is an Orson Welles shot. Yep, this is an Orson Welles movie. And I wasn't able to do it as much because of how muddled I was mentally, but then also, you know, trying to pay attention to the subtitles. So I'll just read from Roger Ebert because why try and say it when someone else has said it better? Welles as director uses some of his familiar visual strategies. The vast interiors of Henry IV's castles contrast with the low ceilings and cluttered rooms of bawdy houses, just as the vast space of Kane's Great Hall contrasts with the low ceilings and dancing girls of the New York Enquirer. Royalty in Charms of Midnight is framed by vast cathedral vaults with high windows casting diagonals of light. Welles uses dramatic camera angles, craning to look up at the trumpeters atop the battlements as Henry IV rides off to battle. At Mistress Quickly's, on the other hand, Falstaff and his roisterers have great freedom of movement involving doorways and posts, barrels and vestiginous staircases, barking dogs, and laughing wenches. He and other actors circle verticals and one another as they speak, just as Welles and Joseph Cotten circled in Citizen Kane and The Third Man. And watch the use of deep focus when he begins a shot with Hal seated in the background and, as news of his father's death is conveyed, Hal stands and moves forward, finally looming over the camera in foreground, all one shot. That is, of course, visually impressive, and certainly one of the ways that Welles adds his own flair or brings something to this movie which makes it not just a filmed adaptation of a play. This also makes me realize that I'm pretty sure I was calling the Prince Harry throughout this entire recording, even though it is Hal. So be it, I made a mistake. Please don't send those emails and or tweets and or Facebook comments. I'm really, this is right now, but Hal, not Prince Harry. So that is certainly visually impressive. And also, you know, a lot of reviews you will say will point to this. And even earlier reviews were willing to praise for this. The way that Welles shoots the Battle of Shrewsbury is, holy shit, it's phenomenal. Like, I have watched this movie not too many days after watching Game of Thrones and the Battle of the Bastards for the, I don't know, 12th, 13th time, basically. But a lot of techniques in that battle scene, shot in 2016 with the benefit of a lot more actors and visual effects and a tremendous shooting schedule, advantages that Welles did not have with this lower budget. I think he had access to only 100 extras through the entire battle scene. Advantages that Welles certainly didn't have, and yet he still manages to shoot a battle scene which evokes a lot of the same emotion and viscera that the Battle of the Bastards does, or at least a lot of just like a lot of modern depictions of medieval combat, which tries to strip the romanticism away from it and kind of make it seem like, hey, this stuff was slow and it was ugly and it was dirty and it was a wretched experience to take part in. You know, I've read that Mel Gibson watched Chimes of Midnight, or at least the battle scenes of Chimes of Midnight, to get inspiration for Braveheart, which you totally see the correlation. I mean, Welles, it's not just, first and foremost, it's impressive because Welles only had about 100 extras, and yet with the way that he shoots it, not just in wide, you know, not just with his taking advantage of the frame with the wide shots and the charging shots, but then also the way that he shoots and cuts the battle sequence together makes it seem like this is just a mass of thousands of people, and it's impressive. He has these constraints, and yet you can't really tell from watching the movie that he had those constraints because of how he utilizes the shooting space and just the all the tricks and trades of the visual medium. It's super impressive. So first and foremost, there's that, but then also, this is anyone who grew up with tales of King Arthur or Knights of Camelot, or which are the same thing, but just these romantic ideals of what it was to be a knight and to be chivalrous and to be graceful in battle and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that is gone and stripped away from this, and which you see, which is historically accurate, these knights being hoisted up on these awkward, they look like swings, but they're hoisted up so that they could be placed on their horses, because with being weighed down with the armor, they couldn't lift themselves up onto the horse, so they had to be lifted up and placed on the horse. It's so goofy looking, but that's how it was, and you just kind of get a sense of like, oh, this isn't going to be like any medieval battle sequence I've ever seen. But then also it's just people smashing into each other and getting stabbed and getting hit over the head and getting kicked and getting tackled and getting thrown over each other's shoulders. And then eventually, by the time the battle sort of wraps up at the end, it's guys grappling and wrestling and rolling around in the mud. And there's nothing graceful. There's nothing romantic about this. This isn't these glorious scenes of battle. This is these down and dirty and just bludgeoning scenes of battle, which is actually how it was. Sure, knights were fighters, but knights were like, fighting was just sort of part of their responsibility. So when they do it, it's not going to be like the choreographed things that you see in Game of Thrones or in Braveheart or in, I don't know, anything where there's these eloquent, elaborate sword fighting like sequences. No, these are just guys getting in, tackling each other, stabbing people, and getting smashed over the head as quickly as possible. Just anything that these people can do to get an advantage over the other person who is trying to kill them. And that's what Wales depicts. And, I mean, it seems unimpressive, or to a certain extent it seems unimpressive now, because now this is stuff we've been seeing for decades. But I don't know how much of this was being done back in the 1960s, where you kind of had the sense of like, hey, this is gross, and this is disgusting, and this is dirty, and why would anyone ever want to pretend to be a knight when they were a kid, when this is what this stuff was actually like? It is, I don't want to say chilling, but it is effective. It is effective filmmaking. It is effective kind of demystifying. It's, despite what little I know kind of about Shakespeare and these historical dramas, it seems like it's right in line with that stuff, of which is just, hey, this isn't pretty. This is just how things are. But that's pretty much all I have at Chimes at Midnight, because I didn't really know what else I could really respond to or say, because I wasn't really understand what I was what I was watching. But the Chimes at Midnight has been this movie which has been described as arguably Welles' most personal film. And certainly the best film of his second half. Half of that I agree with, in which I can see how it's his most personal. I can't necessarily get on board with it being the best of his second half of his career, because one, I haven't seen as much from his second half, and also just it was my own brain which was sort of holding me back from being able to engage with this. But I still think that it says something significant. It says something about the import and the talent of Orson Welles, that despite the fact that I wasn't really fully able to follow what was going on, I could still feel what was going on. I could still feel the good humor of the initial relationship. I could still feel the awfulness and the misery of war and what it can do. And I could still feel the heartbreak and the descent of the relationship between Falstaff and Hal, ultimately culminating in Falstaff's death, the broken heart. I could still feel that stuff. So there's still something for me to respond to, even if it wasn't necessarily with my brain. Welles was a great enough artist where, despite all of that, he was still able to convey a feeling, a sense, an emotion. And that is a sign of good art. a more modern day examples, I say JC Chandor's margin call. I have no understanding of how the stock market works. I don't understand these complex financial terms. And so while a lot of the conversation that was taking place was explaining what was happening and what you know, the options were, I'm like, I'm completely fucking lost as to what these people are talking about. But Chandor is doing a great job of making me feel like, hey, what you're watching right now, this is heavy, this is important, and there's a momentum which carries me forward. And so that at least I have to give the film credit for, because that's absolutely amazing. But Falstaff, you lucky suckers who have Filmstruck have access to stream Chimes at Midnight for free all you want, and you can rub it in our faces if you do. The rest of us suckers, if we want to watch this again, we have to do it by rental or purchase on Vudu and Amazon, or you can just purchase it off of iTunes as well. Amazon, I should say, has the subtitle options. I don't know if Vudu does. I have to imagine it does as well. But at least you can watch Amazon Prime. Not on Prime, sorry. You can watch it on Amazon Instant Video with subtitles on if you think that'll help, as I thought it would. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to do so, as it did not for me. But that's all I got for Chimes of Midnight. If you want to stay in touch with things that I'm doing, or shoot me some feedback, it's youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com is my email address. You can find me on Twitter at @NolanFixesTeeth. You can find facebook.com/IDoMoviesBadly. Go to Battleship Retention for the podcast drop-down menu. Find I Do Movies Badly, or go to I Do Movies Badly on the iTunes store, where you can leave comments on past episodes. And we can kind of talk about Chimes of Midnight, or at least you can talk to me about Chimes of Midnight, and you can talk to me about you know, why you love it so much, assuming you do love it, as the 97% freshness rating on Rotten Tomatoes would indicate. So yeah, that does it for Chimes of Midnight. Thanks for sitting through and listening to my rambling and my thesis on why I am not the right guy to be critiquing or analyzing the works of Shakespeare. Next week is sad, because next week wraps up Orson Welles' month with F for Fake. And yeah, this is a bummer, because I'm despite what I just said about not necessarily being able to connect and understand what Chimes at Midnight, I am really enjoying this month. I'm really understanding what it is to sort of be exposed to the work of a master craftsman. You know, this guy who had full command of cinema. It's absolutely awe-inspiring and daunting at the same time. So be sure to tune in next week, where I'll be wrapping up Orson Welles with F for Fake, the first documentary on I Do Movies Badly, or in I Do Movies Badly history, and well, hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.